So as opposed to my student just hitting that point, because the thing we say, the worst decision that you can ever make is no decision at all. And in fact, most of my friends that have been killed, if I go back over the 20 years of flying, and I've lost quite a few people, obviously, it's just the nature of the job. It tends to be, they're all in control of the aircraft when they died. And there's always something that was causing them to not be able to make a decision, or maybe delay the decision that they were going to make. And there comes a time when you, and it doesn't matter whether it's flying or whether it's business or whatever it is. And the most successful people, if you read all the big books on, you know, the big world leaders, these are guys that take decisions. They appreciate the risk, they take the decision, and they move on with it.
That was fighter pilot, squadron leader, and flying instructor Tim Davies. And this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where we get to go deep and long form and cover all types of interesting topics with some fascinating guests. And I use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to have these great conversations. I hope you enjoy them and get a lot out of them. Things like effective risk taking, successful decision making, and I want you to hang on to those two things as I tee up my guest today. Because imagine having to take some risks and make some split-second decisions with the highest stakes imaginable on the line. And now imagine that when you're doing that, you're under the immense G-forces that can be present in the cockpit of a fighter aircraft. And well, folks, those are some of the things I explore with my guest today, Tim Davies. Tim is a fighter pilot. He's a squadron leader with the Royal Air Force here in the UK. He's based in the Anglesey base in Wales. He's also a coach and the founder of a site called FastJetPerformance.com. And Tim brings a very, I would say, interesting, unique perspective on decision-making and performance because it's based on his experience as a fighter pilot. So this is an episode that is about a whole lot more than just flying airplanes. And in fact, it's a pretty vast conversation. But nonetheless, Tim's perspective on all these things, I think, has been molded in the moments of truth when doing things like preparing for and flying fighter aircraft in critical moments can provide. And the fact that he applies these lessons to all sorts of things outside of the cockpit makes him a really fascinating person to talk to. And that's precisely why I asked him to come onto the show. And we do get into his background and how he started flying jets. We talk about risk-taking and fighter pilots. We go through a typical day, and then we get into some broader themes, things like willpower, associative conditioning, making snap decisions. And I particularly enjoyed the part where we talk about, as you'll hear, mistakes and transparency and having an open culture. That is something that Tim talks about in the context of the Royal Air Force, and I think you'll find that very enlightening. The flying process, we get into mental and emotional states when flying big, fast aircraft. We talk about resilience and tons more. I think you'll enjoy and appreciate Tim. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's Tim Davies. On the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, and I know they're going to have a great conversation, so welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
So, a bit of background for my listeners. You are a fighter pilot with the Royal Air Force here in the UK. You also do some coaching and some mentoring, and while I don't have a set of standard questions, I very often tend to start things off with this question, and that is, when you're asked what it is that you do, how do you respond?
It's actually really interesting that you ask me how do I respond, because a lot of the time when you're at a party or a dinner and you say you're a pilot, of course that tends to get the spotlight onto you. But I actually sometimes say that I do manage risk. That's what I say. Right. I say I'm a risk manager. And then we get onto the subject of the risk that we manage, which happens to be a very aviation orientated risk. But my wife, for example, would tell people that I'm a pilot. I'm a qualified flying instructor in the Royal Air Force. I work in a requirements space as well, and we can talk about that a little bit later. So I'm responsible for bringing in some other aircraft into the service within a particular structure that the Royal Air Force is going through at the moment. So I'm a Royal Air Force commissioned officer. I'm a squadron leader, and I teach people to fly military fast jets.
Cool. That sounds like fun. We're going to get into that, but before we do, actually, it would be very interesting to understand your journey. How did you get into doing this? What led you there?
Yeah, it seems to be the same sort of thing for everyone that I mentor or coach through. There's obviously a deep interest in aviation as a young guy or girl, of course, as you're coming through. And then you tend to go through things like air cadets or whatever it might be. You might go to university, and at university, you all express an interest in a military future as opposed to maybe a civilian one, which would involve flying. And for me personally, I was very academically challenged. I wasn't great. I think Prince Harry said something reasonably recently as well about the fact he doesn't like exams. I wasn't a massive fan of academia. I didn't feel that I was learning subjects. So I didn't do well subjects that I wanted to learn. I didn't do well at school. So every step of the way, I had to try and go into like an HND or whatever it was to repair the damage I'd done for my A-levels. And eventually I managed to get university, and I scraped out of that, and I was rejected by the Royal Air Force. And I spent 4 years with the Territorial Army at university. I was rejected by the Royal Air Force. So I joined the Royal Navy, which I was very grateful for. I spent 5 years in flying training with the Royal Navy. And as it happened, the aircraft I was going to step onto was the Sea Harrier. Right. And going back now to around about 2002, it must have been at that time, it was decommissioned. So the Royal Air Force decided to grab about 8 of us, and it said, do you want to come and fly our airplanes? And we all said yes. And so I ended up in the Royal Air Force through the back door, as it were.
Very cool. That's a testament to persistence, it sounds to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is actually.
Did you always want to do, did you always want to fly? And really, what was the, why was it the Royal Air Force? And why, what was it that attracted you?
Yeah, the thing about flying, it's interesting, because when you look up in the sky at an air show, you look at the sharp pointy things, and it wasn't that I really wanted to fly jets. I really wanted to fly helicopters. And when I came through as my father was a Royal Marine, and then he was a police officer, so he would drag me down to every careers office you can imagine. It was quite painful, really. I'd be doing pull-ups on doors, and my son wants to join the military. And so I think really there was a period in my life in my early teens where my father probably wanted me to go into more of an infantry type, more of the Royal Marines, the Army. And I'd made a decision that I was interested in engineering, I was interested in flying. And around about that time, I decided to fly. It wasn't really, I think at that age, when you are in your late teens, you don't really decide whether it's an airline you want to fly for, or you don't really know because you have such limited information, which is why, and I'm not pimping out my site here, which is why on my website, I try and break down that kind of glossy brochure. I try and tell people that the kind of earthy details about what it is in military aviation that they're going to walk into. But for me, I was open to anything really, because I didn't really know any better. This was pre-internet, remember? This is going back to, the internet was around in mid-90s, wasn't it? So it wasn't the websites you could learn from.
Right.
So for me, it was visiting bases and flying schools and getting an idea. And then really, because my father was military, I decided to join the military. My brother's in the military. He's just left. So I ended up, as I said, by joining the Navy when I was 20, 23, 24. It was quite late, actually, when I joined. So, yeah, about that.
Cool. I was about to ask you how much Top Gun influenced the movie Top Gun, if at all. But it sounds like your influence is much deeper than that.
No, it's interesting you say that. When was Top Gun? What was that year?
85, 86, something like that. Yeah, so mid to late 80s, something like that. Yeah.
Oh, it's awful, isn't it? They're remaking it. Why can't you leave it alone? There was, when we go back into that kind of era, if you look back, there were films like Iron Eagle and all these kind of other films out at the time as well. They never did as well as Top Gun. There's some great If you go on YouTube, there's two episodes, The Making of Top Gun, that goes behind the scenes. And there was this deep frustration that the US Navy had at the time, of course, because Jerry Bruckheimer, he wanted to do something different, and Don Simpson wanted to do something different to what the US Navy wanted to do. You'd never do air combat around mountains like they were doing, but mountains look a lot better. So when you see that sort of thing, and this is something in this is something I tell my wife sometimes, I'm like, reality doesn't matter. Perception matters.
Yes.
And in that film, people wanted to show the Navy in a great light, and they used a bit of artistic license. And these things all have an effect on us, whether we want them to or believe they do or not. So a lot of my students, what do they join up for now? Obviously Top Gun was a long time ago. It's interesting you say, did it have an impact? I mean, everything does, I think, whenever you see. I mean, this is why we have the Red Arrows, for example, because it's a great recruiting tool for us. So, yeah, I wasn't a groupie. We have a currency, of course. Every year we have to watch Top Gun. It's like, it's the law, you know.
Right.
But, it's obviously an interest for a lot of people. So we still.
Well, it is. And I guess that also takes us into some of the conversation around risk. And you say that you're a risk manager. And I wanted to, you know, we might as well dive into this, and we can come back to your you know, career trajectory, and have all sorts of questions around what a typical day is like and this sort of thing. But one of the things that I don't know if you're familiar with the astronaut Chris Hadfield.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Right. So he wrote this great book on Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And
that's right.
From a risk-taking perspective, there are certain professions. So maybe it's being an astronaut, a fighter pilot, other things as well. I had Kate Sukel, who's an author. She wrote a book called The Art of Risk, and she interviewed base jumpers and firefighters and people who you just on the surface you think, well, they're risk takers, you know, and also entrepreneurs. And actually, when you scratch the surface and you talk to these people, you find out, well, actually, they're very good at taking risks, but they aren't reckless people. They've got the risk taking really dialed in. And so rather than, you know, pushing the edge, you know, flying into the danger zone every day, they're actually very they're very thorough. And I just want to maybe talk about the sort of that image versus the reality of what it is you do.
It's interesting, actually. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. When we talk about risk, it's a very calculated risk. Mm-hmm. I think Chris Hadfield's quite interesting, actually, when he talks about it, because I'm pretty sure he follows me on Twitter, actually.
Right.
I'm sure he does. It's interesting because he talks about spiders and his dislike of spiders. And he says, and this is, we all know this, we're just as a race, we're just lazy. But he says that he had a huge fear of spiders. And of course, once you walk through the first spider's web, it's pretty scary. But by the time you walk through the ninth, you've normalized that process. Now, with normalization of any kind of process, of course, it can be that the process can be deviant. And I've written articles about this before. And before you know it, you've normalized a deviant process. So we're really careful in the service, in all the military that I've worked with, of analyzing how we're taking that risk and what is that risk. And is it indeed a risk? And if it is, we need to make it as low as reasonably practical. I'm sure it's a term you're familiar with. We need to make the risk tolerable. We go through risk matrices. And this is at a very strategic level, very high level, of course, because what we do inherently is dangerous. It's combat, it's flying. This is the thing where health and safety come into military flying, because they come on stations and they make everyone wear yellow jackets when they cross roads, and then they see us strapping into warplanes and on rocket seats and everything. And of course, there has to be a place where it stops, else the job can't be done. Do you see what I mean? There's no way we can fly down valleys as a four-ship formation and have health and safety doesn't have a role in that. So we have our own safety structures, which are externally monitored, of course, to make sure that what we're doing has been calculated. And you're right. One of the things, when I meet base jumpers and I meet all sorts of guys, I talk to a lot of pilots, obviously. We're all geeks. We're all a bit boring. I hate to say that. I'm really dull. I'm a really dull guy. No, but it's just we are. And people think we drive fast cars and stuff. And It's not. That's not the sort of job we do. How do I explain this in a way? Anything like decision making or willpower over a period of a day, or empathy, in fact, with business leaders, anything like that. You have an amount of, and over the day you erode that amount. So willpower. In fact, they say willpower isn't eroded, isn't it? The more you practice willpower, the more you get of it. But most definitely empathy is eroded, and your decision-making ability of a day is eroded also. And I think, in all honesty, you know, we have to be careful when we're making these calculations that we do, that we look at it as a fresh pair of eyes, in effect, each time. We don't get ourselves into a position where we're doing the same thing day in, day out, mm-hmm. and we're eroding that to the point where it's dangerous. Because what happens is we have a fatality, then we have a service investigation, and mm-hmm. then those lessons are learned, but people are dead, and that happens. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting business, but coming back to your question, no, we're not that exciting. Obviously, exceptionally good looking, don't get me wrong, but no, we're not the most exciting people in the world.
Well, what does a typical day look like?
And I get asked this question a lot, mm-hmm. and this is a great question to ask people if you want to understand their business, because we build structures into our day. So, mm-hmm. you know, at what time we get up and everything. The thing about being a pilot in the military, unfortunately, is that your day never starts at the same time, frustratingly. It never finishes at the same time. I got back from work literally about 30 minutes ago. I was doing an air combat trip quite late. And tomorrow morning, I'm in quite early to do a swimming test, for example, at 6 in the morning. So that's just one of those things. We have currencies. And so for me, a standard day would be probably an 8 o'clock Met brief, and the Met brief is where we get presented the weather for the day and what we expect that to be. They talk about the state of the airfield, you know, the condition of the runways, what the wind's going to be doing, the weather over basically our operating area, which is the United Kingdom. So we then can plan the sorties. The sorties are programmed already, so we're probably flying. I'll probably fly maybe once or twice a day. Younger guys will fly more to get more experience. More senior guys will probably fly maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And so we'll start with that. That will be a 15 to 20 minute brief in the morning where the whole squadron attends. That can be at maybe 2 or 3 different times depending on whether there's early flights. And then you'll go in and plan your sorties you need to fly. But the flying almost becomes second place. This is where the senior Air Force guys will say, don't say that. And the younger Air Force guys will say, yeah, the flying is secondary to everything else I do in the Air Force. Right. There's a lot of secondary duties to be done. The station needs to be run. There needs to be, you know, the kids' club needs to be run, and the officers' mess bar needs to be run. So there'd be a lot of work in that. Your sorties, there's a lot of briefing before each sortie. There's a lot of debriefing after the sortie so we can get the lessons learned. And then after that, you know, you'll get home, realize they don't pay you enough, and then try and work out whether you go to work in the morning. But that's
right.
It.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. There's no planned lunch break, if that's what you mean.
Right.
It's not we work with the French quite a lot. They do, and I like this. They shut down, and I could give you a random time, maybe like from midday to 1, where the airfield literally shuts and everyone goes and has lunch. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, especially in a safety culture. I think one of the things we do, and also here's the thing as well, Ben, I do believe that we need to be really open and honest when we talk about risk and when we talk about safety. And there's a lot of people that say what they think people want to hear. And I understand that, because we all want to get promoted and earn the big money and have more stress in our lives and everything else, don't we? But, you know, embrace that stress. But they shut their airfield, they go to lunch, they have a lot of chat about what they're doing, and then they go back to work. And we don't do that in our flying communities. We get guys get lunch whenever they can. They fit it in. That helps the program to run better, I guess. But so that's pretty much the day. What else do I have?
So that's that you think there's value in taking that sort of that break, that you're working in a kind of an intense environment, and you can't be 100% all the time.
So, you know, when you have a shower or whatever, and you have these ideas and you come into your mind.
And it may be
something you've thought about a week ago, two weeks ago. That's called associative conditioning. That's the default mind network, default mode network kicking in.
Right.
And what that means is you may have read a book about Einstein, and then you may have, I don't know, gone to your kids' play on stage or whatever. But just those two completely separate things come together in your mind when you have sleep, for example, or where you're doing something that is benign, that is routine, like walking, or having a shower, something that takes no process, and all of a sudden the ideas come to you. And if you don't have that time to think, in our society, of course we don't have that time to think. If you scroll down your Facebook feed, you're looking at cats, you're looking at cars, but you need to take time out of that. So you need to go for walks. And this is what I try and say on my squadron as well. I say to guys, you know, what are you doing for the next couple of hours? They're like, well, I'm waiting for a call from this guy, and I'm not doing much. And I say to them, well, go to the coffee shop, whatever, you know, go to hit the gym, do some rowing or whatever it might be, but get out of this environment, because when you're in this environment, you're not able to look at it in an objective kind of way,
right?
Because you're part of it. So I try and get guys to really remove themselves as much as I possibly can. And by doing, and again, here's the thing as well, because you know as well as I do, that when you get someone that's outside of your industry and they come into your industry and you allow them to speak freely and you say, what do you think about this? All of a sudden, they come up with some ideas that you haven't really ever considered. And then you can work with that and you can make things safer or you know, that's the thing. So,
sure. Yeah. Well, it strikes me that I don't know what goes into planning a mission or a sortie or whatever, but it sounds to me like there are so many variables, right? That you've got, you talked about the wind conditions, the conditions on the runway, the technical, is happening with the planes is probably loads of technical stuff. Whatever it is you're trying to do, and it's I would imagine it's an operation that needs to work at optimum efficiency, and whenever you're working at optimum efficiency, well, you know that you can't there's a limit to it, right? You need that downtime. No organization, Olympic athletes peak every 4 years.
Sure.
You can't go full gas all the time.
Yeah, so we have 3 years on a squadron normally, and then we send the guys either onto another squadron or onto a ground tour. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm on a ground tour right now. Mm-hmm. A ground tour is where you work in an office and you do something else with the military, obviously. So I'm a bit unusual in so far as I've flown for the majority of my career, which has been about 20 years, and I leave next year, in fact, leave next June, just through choice. But for the last, I got to the end of 2015, and the 4 years previously, we'd built a squadron here at RAF Valley. It had been quite quite an arduous time, and so I said I want to do something else. So I was able to go and work in an office now in a town, and that was a great relief to me, really. That was a great break, although I'm still flying part-time. So every 3 years, we realize that guys get, and this is the same in civilian working practices as well. I know there's some companies that I work with. So every 3 years, people change their jobs because else they get stayed. So that's how we kind of combat that. Again, taking leave. I think Sheryl Sandberg said, the chief operating officer of Facebook, she was saying that a lot of people will come up to her and say, I'm going to quit Facebook. I hate Facebook. Mm-hmm. And she would say, she'd look at their leave plan and say, well, you haven't taken any leave yet. And they say, okay. And she'd say, well, take your leave, come back and see me. And if you still want to leave Facebook, you can. They come back and they say, yeah, I'm really sorry. I don't want to leave Facebook. Yeah. But sometimes we have to force people to go on leave. We have to force them to go on holiday because obviously the job is quite intense. And they won't do it. One of my pilots, in fact, was saying, I said, you've got to go on leave. I'm not going to fly you until you've had a week off. And he said, well, the only thing I want to do on leave is fly airplanes. And I was like, he's unusual, by the way. So I said, go on leave. But yeah, you've got to get people away. So that's how we do it in the service. Yeah.
You probably, segueing into, you probably have an interesting perspective on safety and decision making. And I'm not sure how much of this translates into the military, the Air Force or military flying versus civilian flying, but a few things fascinate me about civilian aircraft. And I don't know if that famous case study about Korean Airlines, and how they had an appalling safety record because the hierarchy in the cockpit, because the superior officer could never be challenged on anything, I similarly, you hear these stories about air traffic controllers needing to do precisely what you just talked about, taking a break because they're looking at blips on a screen, and you can only do that for so much time. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on decision making, and particularly in the safety space, because if you get something wrong in what you're doing, the consequences could be quite catastrophic. What thoughts you might have, but it would be interesting to explore that.
I don't know whether you know this, but I'm actually writing a book on decision making. But we're not the decision making. I have a followership that I write for, And when I asked them, what do you want me to write a book on? I thought they'd say leadership and stuff. It was about decision making, but we're not talking in-depth kind of, you know, changing the world decisions. We're talking about every day. How do you make a decision on, you know, which dishwasher to buy when you're standing there in front of, you know, four dishwashers on offer? You know, how do you? And so this is the kind of thing I'm writing about, because, of course, the decisions that we make within the military construct, especially in highly dynamic environments in warfare, with you know, the young army private in Afghanistan being shot at, whatever, or the one of my young pilots, whatever, over North Wales at low level, these decisions aren't ones where you can stop and get your you know, get your matrix out, get your chart out, get your flow chart. It doesn't happen like that. So the decision we make, and people say, well, they're snap decisions and stuff, and that's probably what my book is going to be called. But that's they're not. There's a lot of intuition there, but the decisions we make have got a history to them. So we say a lot of the writings that we have in the military, the books we use, the guides we have, are written in blood. They're written in the stories of the men that and women that have died before us. Of course, we don't want to make those same mistakes. So we listen and we learn from them. And the decisions we have been the briefs that we do for some sorties. The plans and the briefs might last up for 4 hours for 1 hour of flying time. And the debrief might be a further 2 hours. So, because we want to maximize the learning value from those flights. So, I mean, there's, what's a good way of putting this? So when we make the decisions, they're based basically they're based in a huge brief that we've been through prior, and so we use something called what ifs, i.e., the what if this happens. I think the Stoics called that inversion. So they would look at what's the worst that can happen.
Yeah, pre-mortem's another way of
that. Yeah, absolutely. And so this is Socrates and all the guys would sit around in a circle and say, what if my social standing fell next month? How would I deal with that? You know. So that when it happens, it's no longer a shock to you. There's not that paralysis, paralysis of fear. And so that's what we do out there as well. We say, so what if you approaching the target and the weather has come down and you can't get into the valley you need to get into? So as opposed to my student just hitting that point, because the thing we say, the worst decision that you can ever make is no decision at all. And in fact, most of my friends that have been killed, if I go back over the 20 years of flying, and I've lost quite a few people, obviously, it's just the nature of the job. It tends to be they're all in control of the aircraft when they died, and there's always something that was causing them to not be able to make a decision, or maybe delay the decision that they were going to make. And there comes a time when you, and it doesn't matter whether it's flying or whether it's business or whatever it is. And the most successful people, if you read all the big books on, you know, the big world leaders, these are guys that take decisions. They appreciate the risk, they take a decision, and they move on with it. That decision is done now. So I've taken it, I'm moving on, and I'll live with the consequences of it because I need to get to the next decision. And so that's what, you know, when we're traveling at 7-8 miles a minute at low level, you know, every 7 or 8 minutes, every 7 or 8 miles, that just takes a minute to fly. There's not much discussion in the cockpit about what we're going to do. There is a very directed path to take. And if you don't take it, when we get back to the debrief, someone will say, you know, you made an error there because you did not make a decision when you had to. I don't care whether it's the right or wrong decision, by the way. So I say this to my students, the decision you make, I couldn't care if it's the right or wrong one, because invariably the right one could be the wrong one anyway, or the wrong one could be the right one in a different set of circumstances. But I need you to make that decision. I need you to not be scared of making that decision. And there's no place in a cockpit for a pilot who has that fear that they might be wrong in taking a decision. So decision making is something that, you know, we obviously we do, I think someone said about 35,000 times a day. And I think there's 200 of them about food alone, you know, it's a huge factor in our life. And in the cockpit, of course, it we try and minimize those decisions by the planning and the briefing that we go through.
Does that
help at all?
That's really helpful. I guess what you're talking a little bit about is that concept of decision fatigue, where you know, we're really, you know, if you wake up in the morning and we're, you know, wondering what to wear, then that starts to wear down throughout the rest of the day. So
that's true.
Which is why Mark Zuckerberg wears hoodies all the time, and
you know,
that kind of thing. But this concept of just making a decision, whether or not it's the right one, is that something that you train in people? Is that something that can be trained?
Yeah, I think these guys, I assume you're talking about pilots in flight training.
Pilots in you know, flight situations, you know, under lots of stress. You know, it's at what point, you know, do you train people so that you say, right, I've got to make some decision now versus, you know, like how much, what is the point at which more deliberation doesn't help?
Well, you know, normally it's when you're flying to the mountain, to be honest with you. Yeah. So, you know, they were quite fortunate in this country as opposed to other countries insofar as the weather here is quite poor. Mm. So when we are flying, and we do a lot of flying, right. obviously medium and low level, there's right. a lot of weather, there's a lot of structure, and weather forces decisions, of course, because we need to, we can't hit targets at low level unless we can see them necessarily in the very low level environment. And in the medium level environment, if you're conducting an air combat sortie, well, you need to be doing that air combat, that visual air combat, away from the weather, away from the clouds. Sure. So you have to move your operating area to somewhere else. So by the very nature of us taking our students up in that poor weather, that challenging environment, helps them to really get into making those decisions. And I still see it today, in fact, with guys that come back from the front line to be instructors here, we have to say to them, you know, you're not alone in this airplane anymore. You're responsible for another five guys or girls out there in three aircraft. They don't really care whether the decision you make is actually the right one, but you need to be directive. Mm-hmm. You need to show that you're in control of this because mm-hmm. you're now looking after £100 million worth of airplanes mm-hmm. and however much pilots yeah. cost to train. It's quite mm-hmm. So I think by the very nature of the flying we do, we get people to understand the importance of very active, I call it a very active decision making mm-hmm. Process that they have to go through. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah, really cool. It's you know, in the world that I inhabit, you know, the wrong decision could mean loss of a lot of money, but very rarely would it mean loss of a life. And I was just actually having a conversation with another podcast guest earlier today, and she's a mountaineer, and we got into this discussion around skin in the game. When we're talking about lives, it really focuses the mind. Whereas if you're working in a business context, and if you know we could lose the business some money, and in many cases it's not that individual's money, it's someone else's. There, you know, it's a different dynamic. So I don't really know. I mean, how do you approach or cope the possibility of, you know, losing lives in the work that you do?
Well, we have we have obviously a flight safety culture. We have a JUST culture, mm-hmm. so we have a very open reporting culture mm-hmm. in the military.
Sure.
And and people say this doesn't exist in the civilian sector. I work with a lot of civilians, and mm-hmm. it does exist out there. It's just getting people to understand what it really means.
Okay.
A JUST culture doesn't mean there's no blame. What it means is it's a very open reporting culture. And if you're honest and you come forward and you say these are the mistakes that I've made, then everyone can learn from
right.
that.
Yeah,
and yeah, you may have to be re-educated on certain things, but this is for your benefit. It makes you safer.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a very open reporting procedure where I can come down from a flight and I can say, you know what, I performed badly on that flight. There's a reason for it. I might be tired, hungry, whatever, fatigued, you know, in some kind of sense. And I can write a report on this, and then everyone else in flying an airplane in the United Kingdom, in fact, I think it actually ends up online as well. It's an open reporting system. So you can find that. And you can learn from that. Mm-hmm. Now, my brother recently was flying for the Canadians. Mm-hmm. Are you Canadian, Ben? Are you?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he was out in, he was flying out of, he was living in Belleville, so he was out of Toronto. I can't remember the base he was flying at. It was awful. So sorry. Flying Hercules. And he was saying that the reporting procedure there was quite closed. And I think that's to protect people. I think I can understand that, because what they're saying is, you know, if you report these things, we're going to protect you and everything. We're going to make sure it doesn't embarrass you. Mm-hmm. We've done the reverse for that. We've said, look, don't be embarrassed by being open about your errors.
Hmm.
If that's the case, no one's ever going to report an error.
Hmm.
And therefore, no one's going to learn from it. And the reason that we, I think, are a pretty good air force when it comes to, you know, what are the top 10 air forces in the world, mm-hmm. is because we are very open with this. And you'll hear guys in the crew room over a cup of tea saying, I made a mistake yesterday, this is what I did. And there's not one man or woman in that crew that's ever going to criticize them, because they could be next, right? You know, they could be the next guy.
Yes.
And we've all got friends that have flown into the ground anyway. And, you know, if we'd been a bit more open, maybe back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s, some of these things wouldn't have happened. So, and like, you know, the Nimrod, the famous Nimrod accident from 2006, which brought our whole military aviation authority construct that we operate under, there were huge failings in that if people had been a bit more honest about that, that accident probably wouldn't have happened. And the way I call it an accident, it's an incident, isn't it? Because there's always someone or something that's responsible for that. So that's how we do it. It's a big just culture, open reporting. I don't believe people wake up in the morning and go to work thinking, I'm going to do something bad today.
Yeah.
I think we get ourselves into a position where sometimes it's easier to just not be open about something you know, we'll leave it a bit later and then something bad happens and you lose some money or whatever it might be.
Yeah, so we struggle with that. I mean, people in the risk space struggle with that all the time because, you know, raising a risk is, to me, is a good thing. You know, if somebody comes up to whatever organization and says, you know, I think we need to be careful about this. Well, that's a good thing. But in some corporate cultures or organizational cultures, that doesn't happen because, you know, being the bearer of bad news doesn't win you points, unfortunately. But it's much better to raise it and have it not happen than, you know, have it happen and said, well, we should have known about it. But it's a real struggle in some places, to be perfectly honest. And I've seen it. Unfortunately, a lot of the risks that I think occur, particularly the big corporate scandals, if you go back and look at the things that have been public, like Volkswagen and some of the others.
Enron
and there were indications and signs that these things should have been picked up or they would have been if people had listened. And I think that is what you describe as a great way of running an organization, not being afraid to say, well, yeah, I made this mistake or what have you. I think that's a good lesson there. And we also delude ourselves as individuals as well. I think
we do actually. Yeah. It's very easy to do that. That's why you need some real solid friends with you, you know, sometimes, and that's the great thing. I'm a part-time guy on the squadron now, so I just deliver flying training. But when I used to run a team of instructors, my instructors taught the other instructors how to teach the students. That was the idea. And those guys, after a year, were the most honest guys you'd ever come across. So these are the guys that would stand up first thing in the morning in front of the entire squadron as the most experienced operators on the squadron, and they'd still say, look at the mistake I made yesterday. And what they're saying to these guys is, look, if I can do this, then you can do this too. Let's not be embarrassed about it. Now, interestingly enough, sometimes we still have an old school element within the service. And of course, it's a little bit different from them because they're a bit worried about how they look in front of people.
Right.
But that's fine. You know, and I get this in business as well. I don't want to be part of a business like that's a worry about, you know, how they look. So I'm very much into an open sort of culture. And even then, sometimes, to be completely honest with you, I'll come back from a sortie where I've made an error and I'll think, if I tell someone about this, they're going to have a look at the amount of hours I'm flying and they're going to say I'm not current enough to fly these airplanes and they're going to stop me flying. And you know, the first thing I do is I go to another guy in the squadron and I say, I'm feeling this, and he will say, okay, let's talk it through. Why are you feeling this? What are your core beliefs in this? You know, why don't you want to own up to these errors and these mistakes? Because that's what they are. They're mistakes. There's a reason for them. And it just might mean that I'm not that current in the particular discipline I'm teaching. I haven't flown it for a while. I need to go and do some more practice. I might need to grab a simulator sortie. I had a simulator today that went through a whole world of emergencies, and that's all they do. They throw emergencies at you again and again and again. And this isn't a sim you can fail. So they put you in a simulator. There's no failing this simulator. Now, we can fail trips, we can fail some sims, but this particular simulator, this emergency sim, where they everything that can go wrong in the airplane, they test you on. All the mechanical stuff, everything else, and you run through drills, and sometimes you have to eject or, you know. But there's no failure from it. You learn the lessons so that you're better the next time. And that's really powerful, knowing that when you go into these particular sorties, it's not about you passing or failing. It's about you exploring your own vulnerabilities within that space. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
Yeah. So this is why coaches, I think, and mentors are so beneficial to corporations as well, because they're external and they can sit there and they can ask a guy, you know, what are your fears about working here? And then they can explore that and get down. I think in cognitive behavioral therapy, they call it the downward arrow. You can ask questions and get down to the person's core beliefs. And it just makes the organization more powerful. I mean, I'm probably preaching to the converted here. I know I am.
I think my listeners, you know, really resonate with this stuff. So it's great to hear you. It's great to hear you talk about this stuff. So,
sure.
And this is not a show about, you know, or for risk professionals, by risk professionals, sure, you know, about sure. risk professionals. This is a, so this is all really, really useful stuff. I wanted to maybe, I did want to talk a little bit about one's, the kind of desired emotional state or mental state when you're flying. Is it mechanistic? Is it, you know, what type of mentality do you want a pilot ideally to be in? And, you know, when is it a problem that, you know, somebody, I don't know, they had a fight with their girlfriend or whatever. They're just not, you know, just not there. You know, cause I'm curious about, you know, what that's like. You've got loads of information and things that you've got to process and how much, how much is the emotional state really, really matter, and how much of it is just it doesn't, because it's just you've repeated the processes so much that it's just, you know, I'm just curious what your thoughts might be.
Well, even if you are repeating the same thing time and time again, eventually you'll get into a state, and I got into a state before I left flying where I'd normalized my behaviors in the cockpit. So I was able to think about things that weren't relevant in the cockpit, and I started thinking about, you know, where I was going to go shopping in the evening to get food on the way home. I mean, there's no place for that in the cockpit. Let's not be funny about it. These machines are highly complicated and they require attention for a reason. So I realized I needed to take a break from flying when that started happening. So we go into something called the mission bubble, and I think this has a relevance in corporate world as well. When we're about to fly, as I said, the flying process itself might take up to 5 or 6 hours to plan, to brief, to do the flight, to come down, get changed again because we wear a lot of kit, and then do the full debrief. That can take a very long period of time. So as what we might say to someone, if someone comes up to you and says, oh, the station commander's called, or maybe HR have called, or whatever what it is, and they want to speak to you about something, you say to that person, look, I'm in my bubble. And what your bubble means is that your focus is on the flying at the moment. And the focus is on getting that mission or that sortie done to the best of your ability. And you have no time, unfortunately. Mm. There's time in the rest of the day to talk about travel expenses or you know, whatever it might be. But right now, and the mission bubble is recognized. It's recognized in the special forces world. It's recognized in aviation world as well. And it's something that we're quite hard over. In fact, as you get better at flying, of course, you can allow some of these things. You can answer some of these questions, and as you're more senior, like the boss or whatever, you can pay attention to these things. But anyone on the squadron could turn around and say, "Come on, you should be in your bubble." Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're making a phone call, I'll just quickly phone this person, and it's got nothing to do with the flight. Anyone can turn around and say, "Look, you should be in your bubble now. You should be thinking about the flying and only the flying." And they're absolutely right. So there's that, and then there's the emotional element. So I used to. In fact, and I, you know, no names or anything. I used to be on a squadron a long time ago, and one of the guys was going through a divorce, and you could tell he wasn't there. You know, mentally, he wasn't focused. And of course, he'd come to the squadron, and he would say, "I'm definitely up for it. I'm definitely ready." And I used to have to fly with him a couple of times, and you know, I trusted this guy. He's a great guy, and sometimes I'd have to say to him, "Why don't you take the day off or whatever?" You know, it's the last thing he wanted, of course, but you just have to. Most of us can understand when we're thinking about other stuff. That's not in the flying. And sometimes, as I said, coming back to, you know, being open and honest, we might try and hide that because we don't want to be embarrassed about the fact that our minds aren't on the job. But it's natural because we don't always sleep that well. In the West, our diets are pretty rubbish. They're heavily full of sugar, and you know the sugar is the worst enemy we have right now. That and social media, if we can get rid of those two.
Yeah,
you know, if we can do this, then we're gonna have a great nation. But so a lot of people don't, especially the guys I train, have got young children, and so they're not sleeping well. So we rely on that individual to come to work sometimes and say, "I can't fly today. I was up all night, unfortunately." And that's great. Would you rather it the other way? Because sometimes there's pressure. There's pressure like, "Are you sure you can't fly?" And we have to stop that and say, "Okay, so let's use this inversion technique. Let's look at the what happens if this guy who's just told you that he doesn't think he's fit to fly today because he's absolutely knackered and he hasn't got any sleep because of his young daughter is like 2 months old. If you put pressure on him and he goes flying and he doesn't come home at the end of the day because he's flown into a mountain in North Wales, let's have a think about that. So where does that leave us? So the emotional state is very important. We look after each other. We're externally validated by a separate unit that's based out of the center of the country, RF Cranwell. They come up and they do check rides with us. And so we have things put in place. Any one of us can turn around to any other one of us and say, Are you sure you're up for this today? In fact, last week, it happened at the Outbrief, so the place where you're signing the jets out. And we have a person there specifically to just check these things and to make sure the jets are signed out properly, to make sure everyone's dressed correctly, they haven't forgotten anything. Right. They've got their maps, whatever they need. And he said to one of the guys, are you happy to fly because you've flown twice today already? And the guy said, yeah, I think I am. Let me just take a second. And he said, no, I think I'm okay to fly today. Yeah, I've got another guy in the jet. You know, I'm prepared for this trip. I'm not feeling tired. I'm happy. Hmm. But if he'd said no, no one would have questioned anything. Mm-hmm. He can go back to the crew room and drink tea. Mm-hmm. So he can sit there and read a magazine or whatever he needs to do some extra work. So we do look after each other in that respect. And that's one of the great things about the service. So in that respect, yeah, the emotional element is really important in the airplane. And
yes,
it's important to have and you know, if you want to talk about psychology or mental health as well, there's other aspects there. I think we could do better there. But, you know, we make sure that we are looking after people before we put them in these exceptionally expensive airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I sometimes have guests on my podcast, and it is a podcast about risk and resilience. And sometimes we get to talking about things like diet, meditation.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, things that can make us resilient, more resilient. And and every now and then I might get somebody that says, why do you talk about this sort of thing? This is a risk podcast. And to me, this is pretty core, right? You try making a decision when you're tired, when you're hungry, when you're not in the right space mentally. You know, we need to take care of all those sorts of things. So I guess the support outside of the cockpit in those regards is really important. You know, if you're hungry, if you're not eating right, you talked about diet a moment ago, you know, you're not going to be 100%.
Yeah. And it's a big bugbear for us as well, because, you know, I'm not going to talk down about what we do in the Air Force, but there's room for improvement in every business.
Sure.
And
yeah.
You know, we feed our pilots biscuits, you know. This is how far the budget stretches, biscuits and crisps, and we have a bit of fruit. But there's, you know, there's not the kind of food you'd expect. You know, there isn't there isn't the pasta and the, you know, the everything else you need. It's not, it takes money. Everything, as you know, comes down to money. So we can all take better, more considered risk if we can come up with more money. But this is what a LARP is for, isn't it? It's lowest reasonably practical. I mean, it's working out the point at which it becomes financially, you know, financially unbeneficial, really, to lower that risk any further.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we do. We talk about this a lot, really. And don't get me wrong, fighter pilots aren't the greatest meditators in the world. although I do have the Headspace app on my
cool.
phone.
Yeah.
But you know what Headspace does for me? It's interesting because I went through a bit of a readjustment back in 2014, 2015, and yes. I saw an Air Force psychologist, in fact, psychotherapist.
Right.
I went down to a place in Telford, and I saw a guy down there. I had two sessions with him, really beneficial to readjust my framing of what I was doing.
Sure.
He kind of reframed my mind, made me realize that the job wasn't as important as I thought it was. But that's a great thing. And so I have this Headspace app, and what that does for me sometimes is it just allows me to make a switch between my leaving work and having an evening. Because I think in a lot of jobs we do, especially at the levels we operate, and I'm sure your listeners are at these levels as well, the job is all consuming.
You can make it all consuming, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Of course you can. And we like the fact it makes us feel important.
Yes.
It makes us feel like the boss phoning us at 10 o'clock in the evening on a Wednesday. It's like, sorry, honey, I've got to get the phone. The boss is on the phone. It makes us feel important.
Yes.
Or having to go into work on a Saturday. Look how important I am.
Yes.
And it's wrong. It is wrong, by the way.
Yes, it is.
There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
And I speak a lot to the NHS and consultants and doctors. And they're always public sector. We've been on a pay freeze, and I get it. And one of the reasons I'm leaving is because of this. But when I speak to them, I say to them, they're their own worst enemy, because they go to work the whole time. They will do an 18-hour shift. They will get called in the next day for another 18-hour shift. They won't work their core hours. And by doing that, you don't get to see how depleted of a resource the personnel in the NHS actually is. And so it doesn't look like you've got any problems. So if it doesn't look like you've got any problems, no one's going to resource it properly, and you're going to have to keep doing your ridiculous working hours. And that's because people don't see it as a job, of course, as we know, Ben.
Yeah.
They see it as vocation and
an identity, right? People attach, you know,
identity. Exactly. And it happens in the service as well.
Yeah.
It happens in the financial sector a lot.
It happens in financial. I worked in management consulting. It happens there.
It's huge.
You know, it is a big problem because, you know, I've been on projects where, you know, you're only billing 8 hours a day.
Yeah, that's
you're working, you know, 12 or more, sure. right? And, you know, that's completely wrong. And people do it, particularly I find, and I've learned this lesson myself, but I find the younger professionals do this because they, you know, they're really, you know, they're newer into their careers and they sure. attach a lot of identity into what it is that they do. And sometimes we do have to do that, I think, but...
yeah, I think we do, yeah. I think you're absolutely right to do that, yeah.
But not all the time.
I've got no issue with it in a way, really, because I think, you know, young and energetic, you're learning the ropes and stuff. Mm-hmm. I just want people to appreciate that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying if a doctor does an 18 or a 20-hour shift and then they make a mistake and the person dies, is it the doctor's fault? Mm. Or is it the management's fault? Mm. Or is it the trust's fault? Or is it the government's fault? I mean, where does this actually end right now? Because if we're responsible managers, we'd say to that doctor, you've worked 8 hours, go home. Yeah. You're not allowed to work anymore. Yeah. If we've got a shortage there, we're going to get some other staff in, but you're going to go home. Because I want them to be fit for the job. If I had pilots working 20 hours, I wouldn't put them in an airplane. Mm. Mm. You know, I have a pilot. We have a 12-hour shift day. In effect, it never gets to that, really. We work about 8 to 10 generally, probably right. nearer the 10, to be honest with you. And depending on operations, is obviously different, of course, because we're on operations, we're in conflict. But we have to make sure that our guys are rested. It's one of yes. the things we have to. And I know the army will hate me for saying that because I think the army is the last thing they do is sleep, isn't it? It's weapon, feet, food, sleep, I think it is. But, you know, when you're flying an airplane, that costs you... Yeah, £100 million.
Well, it's also special forces. The Navy SEALs in the U.S. are famous for that.
Sure.
And I suppose there is an element of training, and you know, you need to do that for certain missions and things like this. But similarly, we can't be flying. You know, we can't be walking around in that state all the time.
It's interesting, actually, you say that because I get a lot of people that make decisions in the business sector, and what they do before they make a decision, a high finance decision, mm-hmm. is they just go to bed. They take a nap for an hour.
Yeah.
And I find that amazing because the best decisions we're ever going to make are the ones when we first wake up, really. I mean, it's when we're most creative as well.
Yes.
And yet we have meetings at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yes. Well, when do you ever get to work? I mean, if you get to work and you have a meeting first thing, it's an absolute waste of your creative talent for a start. Right. You shouldn't be in a meeting. You should be creating something wonderful, you know, but we never do.
Yes.
So we come straight to work and have a meeting. However, most meetings happen in the afternoon when everyone's tired, everyone's on that kind of, you know, that carb low.
Yeah.
No one's interested, everyone wants to go home, and we're expected these amazing decisions to manifest themselves out of nowhere.
Yes.
And it's not going to happen. I really believe in the power of rest. I never used to be into sleep at all. Mm. And now I say to myself, I will try and get 7.5 hours. I mean, that's awful. I never get 7.5 hours, but that's what we should be trying to get.
Yeah.
I used to think that if you did like 5 hours sleep, you've got more of a day to do
sure.
stuff with.
Yeah, yes.
But your day is worse.
Yes,
your
quality. Yeah.
Your quality is such less. It's interesting, isn't it? So now I say, okay, I want a more quality. I want the day to be more of a quality day where I'm performing higher. And so now I will try and maximize my time at rest. And I'm not a huge going to bed kind of guy. Yeah. I hate that. But and I'm always after midnight and always kind of horrendous stuff. But I know what you mean.
Yeah. I know what you mean, and I'm working on it, but
yeah, exactly.
But you're right. I mean, there is a false economy, right? And we kind
Absolutely.
Of see things in a kind of a linear way,
mm-hmm.
You know, an hour is an hour, but it's not. You know, an hour when you're really switched on is different from an hour where you're kind of, you know, sleepwalking through a meeting or you're not fully present, or and it's becoming harder and harder with social media and all this stuff.
Oh, social media is so harsh. I try and my sister just She phoned me up. She was really upset, and she said, "How do I stop my news feed on Facebook?" Because she wants to be in the groups. Whenever she goes and looks at the groups, because she, you know, she's got all these pets and everything else. She sees this news feed about her friends doing really well with stuff, and it really upset her. So we had to, we kind of just suspended a news feed. You can get apps, whatever, that do that. And now she has the groups because it's toxic. Let's not pretend it's not toxic. Social media is a toxic thing that is. You know, unfortunately, at the moment in our generation or whatever, we're all going to suffer from this. So
I think it's already happening. And I sometimes, you know, catch myself and I'm looking at a web page and some article, and I'm like, how did I get here? You know, and it's just like, you know, I clicked on this and this and this, and it's just we need to find strategies to not let it control us. And
you need to time it. You need to give yourself an hour, Ben. That's what I do. Yeah, I say to myself. Yeah. You know, and because I do a lot of writing. So when I see an article like that and I'm reading an article, I'm thinking, why am I writing this? How has the author got me to read this article?
Yes.
So I go back and I look at the title of it and I look at the first paragraph and I'm like, how have I got down to the middle of this? Yeah. There's an art for that, you know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So I'm quite impressed with that. But you're right. I end up reading articles about stuff I don't want to read. We know it's all created anyway on social media. So we're not reading, you know, if you're a right-wing guy, you're reading right-wing stuff.
Yeah,
you
know, echo chambers and...
Oh, all that stuff. You're never reading the alternative view. And I love the alternative view. It makes us better people, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I guess in the military, most of us are right-leaning. I think I'm probably a bit left-leaning. And in the recent election, I was very interested, for example, without getting too political, but I was very interested in what Jeremy Corbyn was saying, because it was something that we hadn't really heard before. We'd heard very centrist policies from Blair and everything else. And governments are centrist. And here was this massively, well, not even massively, but very left-leaning politician. So I ended up reading a lot of that stuff.
Yes.
Which it kind of opened my mind up to a whole world of stuff I hadn't really kind of experienced before. And it makes you more of a balanced person. I honestly believe that.
It's hard. It's hard to do, but it's what we need people to do.
It's hard. It is hard.
It's what we need people to do, but it's it is quite difficult. I had a professor in the U.S. guy by the name of Gleb Sapirsky, and he's kind of an activist, but he developed this thing called the Pro-Truth Pledge, which is all about so let's have these conversations, but let's, as long as we kind of stick to the sources and try and be, you know, objective and, you know, that kind of thing. It's hard. It's, you know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to implement, but we definitely need to, you know, to hear what people are saying and understand, you know, why, you know, why the world is the way it is. And, unless we start to do that more, we're not going to make any progress. I want to get into your coaching and mentoring, because we haven't really talked about that.
That's all right.
I wanted to understand, you know, where did that come from, and who do you coach, and what types of things do you mentor people around?
Well, I'm not here to get business. So you know, I'm a serving military officer. So people within the services, obviously I mentor that. I don't charge for that mentoring. The reason I charge for the coaching is because I have to, because I don't have the time. You probably get this well yourself, and it really upsets me, because I, like you, I'm more than happy to sit there and chat to someone for an hour. I don't need to get paid for that, but I don't have that hour anymore.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah,
it doesn't exist anymore. So I have to charge for it, unfortunately. But so I coach a lot of people in people that are in the transitional state, really, from their mid-30s into probably the late 30s, that are looking to step up into a middle management type thing.
Right.
And I don't tend to coach many people in their 40s. There's I saw a psychotherapist a while ago that said that especially men have you know, people talk about the midlife crisis, and he called it a recalibration. I quite like that, because we should be dead now, shouldn't we?
Yes, that's right.
You know, we go back, you know, to when we were running around with dinosaurs or whatever. You know, we should be dead, because we would never have lived this far. So I think men are, we get to this stage and we're trying to work out exactly who we are and why we're here.
Yes.
And that's quite interesting. So I think when men get up to that, and when they get over that, I tend to talk to them. And what I love talking about really is, you know, why we're doing what we're doing, really, and what people's core beliefs are. And it's not, I like the people that are all of a sudden thinking about whether they need to get into that senior management role. You know, what does it mean? Why do they need to get
into
the senior?
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a whole interesting area.
Yeah, it's what is it for you? Is it a core belief somewhere that you feel that by doing that you're going to bring value into your organization? Because if it is, then that's probably a good thing to do, and you need to do that. You've got to give yourself an out, of course. You've got to work out how long you're going to be there. But the other thing, I mean, a lot of people do it for, of course, is because that's what's expected of them.
Yes, it's status.
It's awful, isn't it? And it's such a waste of a life, because, I mean, my mother, for example, she phoned me yesterday, and she's 75 now. And she said, I might not live another 10 years. I might not be around. And she said, but I still feel as if I did when I was 25, you know? And it kind of hits you a little bit. And you think, well, for me, that's going to be in about 30 years' time. How do I want to live those 30 years? Do I really want to go out and try and buy the Lamborghini or the massive house? And why do I need a massive house? And why do I need a Lamborghini?
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. People have different goals. So we talk these things through. I have some frameworks. I work with people.
Right.
I have some plans we run through. There's one of them that I wrote about recently where I tell them to imagine going and sitting down and having a dinner with themselves. Except that self is the person that's, you know, always made the right decisions and never done anything bad, has always had a great diet. How different does that person look to you? And what would you talk to them about? Would it be embarrassing? Yes. And then I say, well, you know, if we make these changes we're thinking of making, then in, you know, and you could then go and have that dinner with that person in 10 years' time. So I get them to write down a 10-year plan of what they do when they wake up in 10 years' time. It was, it came off, I think, one of Tim Ferriss's podcasts, something, and I've kind of adjusted that a little bit. But that's quite a powerful thing. People write that down, and then they go and read it every 6 months. And what you find is change happens. They don't go out and try and make that change. It just happens. Mm. And before you know it, they're eating better. They're exercising better. Spiritually, they're better. Mm. Emotionally, they're more tolerant. Resilience is a huge factor that we neglect. But all of a sudden, they start having these negative feelings from friends and colleagues, or whatever. They bounce off them. They don't pay attention to them anymore because they realize that there's always going to be someone that dislikes you, and it's nothing personal. It's just the fact that that's just how life. So. Yeah. So they have a better life from it. And I have a lot of people contact me again, maybe 3 or 4 years down the line, saying, you know, the conversations we have and the narratives we went through has really assisted them, and their life is a lot better. And, you know, you can't ask for anything better than that. Mm. That's worth more to me than money.
Mm.
You know, that's the thing. That's the great thing about it. So that's why I coach now. That's why I do the mentoring as well. The mentoring for some of the younger guys and girls, and not all these people are in the British military. A lot of them are in other militaries. On a one-to-one basis, I might do one or two of these sessions a month. It gets them to look at what they're doing really with their lives, and hopefully I can stop these youngsters making the mistakes that you and I probably made, and probably, you know, then again, we'd probably learn from them, didn't we, to be honest.
Well, there's going back to decision making, it's you know, we go on a path and see where it leads you. I think if you approach things that way, then you know, it's hard to go wrong, but you're right. I mean, I think we could, you know, when I was growing up, achievements all, you know, is super important. And I think as men, it's achievement is a big thing, right? That we need to the job, the title, the status, the you know, the whatever. And you come to a point where you're like, well, wait a minute, where does this all lead? Do I want to become a partner in a major Absolutely. Consultancy or a law firm or whatever? And I think sometimes the sooner that we can realize, you know, it's about trying to. For me, there's an internal versus it's that locus of control, whether it's internal or external. So you're trying to satisfy some kind of external picture of what success and performance and all that good stuff looks like, or some type of internal picture of what that should be.
Yeah. But you're right. But my next book, and you know, the reason I'm writing a book is so I can write a book and get better at writing the next book. Does that make sense? And then the next book will be better. And I'll make mistakes, and I'll learn from those mistakes as we go along. Yeah. And hopefully one day I'll write something really good, and it might change someone's life. And that's all I can ask for. But what I'm really interested in writing about is masculine vulnerability.
Right.
And especially in high performance teams, things like this, and how we can kind of express this and how we can understand it more. Because a lot of the guys I work with, because you probably think of a fighter pilot as a very glass chewing, you know, go out there, the top gun type.
Right.
And it's not that personality doesn't fit in.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I'll kill 1,000 people first thing in the morning if I have to, but that's not what I wake up wanting to do. You know, none of us joined the Air Force to go and kill people. We joined the Air Force because they had the best airplanes.
Yes.
All right. I can't fly these airplanes anywhere else. Yeah. So we joined the Air Force. It just so happens that sometimes I've got to go and fire missiles at nasty people.
Yes.
But here's the other thing about it as well, is I've never been in a conflict in my life where the other party hasn't thought that what they were doing was the right thing.
Yeah.
So all of us think we're doing the right thing.
Yes.
No matter who you're fighting against. And that's quite an interesting concept to have a look at. So for me, being open, being vulnerable, and exploring what that actually means, especially today in 2017, especially when, you know, women are doing so well. I'll get loads of haters for saying that, but I firmly believe, you know, I train women pilots all the time, and their training is the same as the men. They do exceptionally well. They're in some very high places now within the service, and rightly so. Of course they should. Why would they not be? But to me, it's interesting what it means now to be a man, and how men speak to other men, and there's still that kind of two lines, isn't there? I always say the squadron is, if you go into a squadron when you're ill or you're a little bit ill, you go into the squadron, you're like a lion with a thorn in its paw. Does that make sense? And the other lions don't have thorns in their paws. And other lions are expecting you to go out hunting with them and to go and get the gazelles. And you're there saying, I can't run as fast as you guys. I've got one on my paw. There's no place for you in a squadron when you're ill.
Yes.
So my men used to come in with coals and they said, oh no, I can do one trip, I'm good. And I used to say, no, I want you to go home, I want you to go and buy yourself a PlayStation, or you know, I don't care what you do, but I don't want you to come into work with a thorn in your paw, but I want you to be open about you know, about doing so. So that's sort of those kind of topics, really, about, you know, men and our place in the world, that interests me at the moment.
It is. I think something is happening, but particularly in some parts of the business world, you know, there's something that still persists about what it means to be to be a man and to be masculine. And there's something that, you know, that is you know, it's perfectly natural, right? About our whatever our hormone, the way our hormones are set out, and you know,
true.
But
is it wrong as well? I mean, that's the thing. I've got a friend who says, no, my place should be in the workplace, and I want my wife to be in the house. And you know, when you talk to him about it, and when you explain it, his wife wants to be in the house with the kids. Right. She wants to be the primary caregiver. I understand that, and I think, you know, we shouldn't chastise men for. Or indeed women for these sort of antiquated stereotypical views necessarily. We should try and understand why they're there.
Does that
make sense?
So I would say, as long as it's a choice and it's an active choice, sure. Versus and it isn't based on, you know, lack of opportunity or, you know, and I would say, you know, we still have a long way to go in that regard, but you know, I mean, I think definitely men are not open enough. We tend to not be open enough in our, you know, expressing feelings, or, you know, and we're, you know, every human being has got fears and anxieties and all that stuff. That's the way the brain works. And, you know, the more that I think we can acknowledge that and just work through, you know, just deal with it, work through it, as opposed to repress and hide it, then I think I think we're all better off, not just in the workplace, but outside of it.
Oh, don't get me wrong. This comes back to risk again, doesn't it? Because we tend to find a lot of these men that aren't in touch with these kind of, if we want to call them emotions, we call them emotions, whatever it might be. These can sometimes be the guys that take the most risk. Yeah. And it's not a calculated risk. It's a flagrant risk. It's an unappreciated risk. And these are the guys who are going to lose a company a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's what I really wanted to try and understand, really, is how better to communicate these things with each other so we don't become these kind of people.
Right. Have you read the book The Hour Between Dog and Wolf?
I have not. No. What's the last one I read? No, go on. So I'll write that one down.
Yeah, it's called The Hour Between Dog and Wolf by John Coates. I think his name is first name is John, but his surname is Coates, Coates. And I just had a similar conversation earlier today with my previous guest, Kathy O'Dowd, and she's a mountaineer, and we were talking about risk, and she was saying how in some cases someone's perception of their skill can be a lot higher than it is because they might do something risky and kind of get away with it.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
They don't know that, you know, that actually, you know, it was just a bit like you walk through a field full of landmines, and you get through it doesn't necessarily mean that you're good at spotting landmines or knowing where to walk, but it, you know, it might just be pure luck. But you, if you go back and attribute it to skill, then you could then in the future make riskier decisions. And this book, The Hour Between Dog and Wolf, does talk about that in the financial services space. Really? And how, you know, traders make a good trade, and actually, you know, we can get particularly men, but we can get a testosterone kind of boost, this guy's a neuroscientist, and you know, the traders can make riskier and riskier decisions up until the point where the thing blows up. It is interesting, and one of his proposed solutions is to get more women on the trading floor.
I get that.
But
they don't really want to be there because they don't want to be amongst all those kind of macho men. It's the biases, isn't it? And the heuristics and biases, and the confirmation bias is one of the ones you'll probably talk about. The sunk cost fallacy. All these kind of things come into to these biases that are inherent within us. They've been there for since evolution. Have these biases within us, but I think the importance is recognizing that these biases are there, because we can't change them, but we know we're probably going to take more risk if we get away with things, because we feel we can. So, but this is where you need external validation. This is why you need the financial services industry, whatever, to step up and be powerful. This is why you need politicians to not be promoting in their parties, whatever, or guys that have been, I think in America at the moment there's a guy just been picked up in Trump's administration, and he he was instrumental in the collapse in 2008. He's always been pro big bank, of course, and these kind of things. And I'm not, you know, whether it's right or wrong, I haven't got enough information on it, really, to be honest with you. But this is the truth, isn't it? We get away with something, we think we can get away with the next time. So we have put things in place in flying to make sure it doesn't happen. We have check rides all the time to go flying with people, and so people can say to you, you know, what you're doing is unsafe. I mean, it's not always like that, but
yeah, it's a fascinating, decision making is fascinating. So I think you're it comes at a good time. When is your book? When are you planning on finishing this?
Well,
book?
I have a great editor, I have to say, and she decides to remove a lot of content. What I tend to do is I overwrite. I quite like overwriting, and then she will strip out and remove, and hopefully we condense that into more of a quality package. But really, this it's really strange, isn't it? Because I don't want to talk down a book, and I'm not talking down it really. I think it'd be really interesting to a lot of people. You can only put so much in it, and there's so much that I want to write about. And to write about decision making in this construct, in a cockpit, decision making in a flight pilot, and how that benefits us outside of it, I really like to expand that. You know, I read Matthew Syed's book, Black Box Thinking, I think it was, and that kind of. You know, he's able to go through a lot of different things. And I think a lot of us who have, we've got full-time careers, right? We don't have the capacity to be able to write in that kind of breadth at the moment. But I would like to get to that. So the book goes out to what's called the beta readers, who hopefully will read it and come back and tell me whether it's good or bad. That goes out, I think, next week. And so hopefully in a month or so's time, it should be out.
Cool.
I think a lot of stuff, if you want to read about it anyway, is on the website. So you can... Yeah.
Very good. We covered a lot of territory, so I know you have to get up really early to do your swim tomorrow. But was there anything that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to mention?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the last podcast, I don't know how many you've done since this one, but the chap that talked about the Russian businesses.
Yes.
And one of the things he said was that the Russian businesses, they don't want any they want the black and white. They want it. And I fully appreciate that. And sometimes I say to the guys in the squadron, as much as I appreciate your opinion, I want the facts here. We've got to make a decision based on fact. And you know how it is. Whenever anything goes wrong, guys start with, you know, what I think. It's like, I understand that. And we can talk about your feelings in the bar later over a beer. But right now, we need to solve this. So I think when it comes down to risk taking, I think maybe taking out the, some of those things out is quite important initially. The feelings about, I mean, don't get me wrong, intuition is exceptionally important. Gut feeling is a hugely beneficial thing that we're really blessed with. But get the facts down first, then address it with stuff later on. And that's something that I just wanted to kind of cover, is making sure people, because I do get, you know, people are very opinionated and some people are very persuasive. Persuasion is its own science, of course.
Yes, it is.
A lot of the time we do things because, you know, we want to impress people. And that isn't necessarily the best thing for your company. The best thing for your company is to do what's going to benefit it the most, or help the people out the most in that. And that isn't normally based on opinion. That's based on things that are tangible and can be measured as well. You know, that's the thing. So that was just, as long as we covered that, you know, I think we've covered quite a few things here. And it's really sad, actually, because there's a lot of things we probably could talk about. We're not going to have the opportunity.
Oh, we could have you back. That's not a problem.
We didn't talk about flying fighter jets, did we, too much? Isn't that a shame?
We talked a little bit about it, but if you wanted to...
That's okay. I don't know what
We can expand on. I mean, I didn't want to get into the technical side of flying fighter jets, but we could have talked about G-forces and things like this. That would have been pretty interesting.
Making decisions when you can't see too well, and obviously the oxygen is deprived, your brain's deprived of oxygen, those things as well. I mean, that would be interesting. How do you make decisions when really you're performing?
Do you have a story or something that you could just maybe quickly share around that
you can think of? I mean, I was on a service inquiry, which is an accident investigation. That was back in 2011 into a death of a friend of mine, and that's exactly what happened to him. Unfortunately, he became unconscious. He was a member of the Royal Air Force aerobatic teams, the Red Arrows. And there's an accident report or an incident report online that would talk about exactly what went into that. But he was killed at Bournemouth Airfield recovering from a display, and they all pulled G in the aircraft, and unfortunately he wasn't prepared for it as much as the other pilots were, and that killed him. So
when you say pull G, what does that mean for my non-aviation listeners.
That's absolutely fine. Yeah. So, you know, when you stand on the brakes in your car and your body moves forward.
Sure.
If you can imagine that an aircraft, when it turns, it has to, like on your airliner, it has to bank the wings to turn. And airliners do about 30 degrees. Well, fast jets don't turn that well at 30 degrees. You need to be like 80 degrees to turn a fast jet because of the way the wings are. And so in doing so, you pull G, which means that it's an acceleration through the normal axis. So through your head. And then through the bottom of the airplane. And what that does is it's what leads to something called G-lock, so G-induced loss of consciousness. And that's the depletion of oxygen in the brain, which means the brain shuts down to protect itself. And you become unconscious. Now, this isn't exactly what happened. My friend, he went through something called A-lock or P-lock, which is partial loss of consciousness. But for all intents and purposes, he became unconscious through lack of oxygen to the brain and was unable to recover the aircraft before he hit the ground. Now, when we make decisions in air combat, of course, and the air combat I was doing today, I was pulling six or seven times my the force of gravity, so my own weight. And so even moving your head around in that is difficult. Your hand and your arm is on your leg holding the stick. The aircraft shaking is in what we call the buffet, because the air is separating off the wing because it's performing it to the maximum ability it possibly can. And then we're still trying to make decisions and still trying to see. And of course, the whole world closes in because the blood in the eye goes out, so you get this kind of, we call it the gray fog, starts closing in, you get tunnel vision, it's hard to see, everything becomes monochromatic, it becomes gray. To operate under those kind of pressures means that you have to prepare a lot in advance. You have to know where to look for the enemy aircraft, you have to know what comm you come out, so what radio communication you have to come out with, and we practice this on the ground. So everything we do is rehearsed before we get up there, so we can minimize the chance of something going wrong. And that's something that I try and bring into mentoring and coaching as well, is trying to practice these things. So if you're going to ask for a raise from your boss, for example, you go and get one of your buddies to pretend to be that boss. You know, so you've almost rehearsed. You rehearsed it before you go in. So now you're less tense. Your boss might answer you in a way you haven't thought about. So, you know, when it comes down to things like that, that's the things we practice in on the ground a lot before we get airborne. Because when you're operating in those environments at 20,000 feet and you're under, you know, 6 or 7 G. You know, in Top Gun, when he said, I think it was Maverick said, you don't have time to think. You know, if you think, you're dead.
Yes.
There's a lot of truth in that statement. And we all laugh at it, of course. Why not? But this is what I'm talking about, the decision making. If you think too much, you'll fly into that hillside. You won't make that correct decision. You'll fly into the other airplane that you haven't been able to see because you're suffering under 7 G and you haven't been looking out properly, or your neck's too weak or whatever and stuff because you've been doing air combat for too long. So, there's a lot to be said for that in the preparation.
There's a lot of good stuff there, and I think a lot of it is transferable to we go back to this sort of concept of stoicism and crises, and you know, what would you do if everything went wrong, and you know, thinking through that before it happens. Once it does, you put in that program that you've practiced, and
you're absolutely right. You know, it's interesting because the last thing my wife and I, and it sounds awful to people when I tell them this at a dinner party, but we have like a divorce plan. So it sounds really bad because people say, well, if you have one, it's going to happen. It's like, no, all it is just saying in the heat of the moment, if everything goes wrong, we've just laid stuff out. You know, in her business, she has a flood plan. She has a fire plan. She has a burglary plan. So before it happens, she's got all the numbers of the insurance companies down. She's got, you know, everything's there. So she had a flood about 4 weeks ago. She was able to grab the folder at home. I've had a flood. What do I do? Open it. Page one. It says it's a flow diagram. You know, does the flood mean you can go to work? No. And then you follow it down. There's numbers there. There's people to call. These are thought out when you're not in crisis. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you don't have the time to think about
it. You don't have the time. You're thinking straight and you've thought them out and you can add to them. And it amazes me how many people haven't thought these things through. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, you don't want to think about the worst happening. Sure. Somebody dying or something. But, you know, there are things, you know, what if you lost your job and stuff? Yes. Have you got enough money in the bank? That's really what professional military aviation is about, is that planning, that really looking at the what ifs.
I'm a big advocate of that type of thing, and I, you know, rather than viewing it as a negative, I kind of view it as a positive thing, because it gives you confidence. Because actually, if you do that what if thinking, oftentimes you find wouldn't be as bad as we thought it would be, right? And
that gives
you confidence to go ahead with something, because you know, the worst is like, okay, that would suck, but we get through it.
Take a month or so.
We're gonna,
yeah, be
we're
fine.
Gonna,
yeah.
You know, going to go ahead with this. So that, you know, that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if it does happen, then you've gone through some type of thought process around what it is you're going to do. Not, you know, oh my God, I'm, you know. So I think it's a very positive thing to do that gives you a lot of strength with regard to making decisions and moving forward on some things that you might otherwise not do.
Yeah, it makes you take action. I think one of the biggest epidemics we have right now is people are planning for too long. They're procrastinating. Mm. People don't execute anymore. I had to take the word execute out of my book, by the way. Because, I know, I had to go through it. What do I use instead? I think take action or actioning. But the word execute has connotations, of course, at the moment in North Africa and everything. But I mean this, you know, people don't execute stuff. They deliberate and they procrastinate and it becomes a thing. You know, it becomes something bigger than them, and it's, you know, they have to ask people's opinions on it. Yeah. And it's like, just do it. Mm. Just get it. It's not going to be as bad as you think it is. Mm-hmm. Just get out there and do it, especially when it comes to diet and fitness and stuff we know is going to be good for us.
Yes.
Go through that initial bit of pain. If you're going to give up sugar, you know what? You're going to have headaches for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And we know that's going to happen. And you know it. You can read about it online. I mean, you know, I quit drinking for a year. I'm doing a year without. And I'm 9 months in. And I'll tell you what, the first few months, they weren't the best months in the world. Mm-hmm. I can guarantee they weren't the best months in the world. And I'm not saying my world is hugely better now in any kind of shape or form. But having a break from alcohol for me was a real positive thing. Mm-hmm. So it's worth those first few months. It's worth me saying, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to work through it and see how it comes out the other side. And you do get resilience. And one of the biggest jobs that's missing right now from companies around the world is the chief resilience officer.
Yes.
and that's someone that we really need in these businesses, because Facebook's going to fail. Google's going to fail. Apple's going to fail. One day, they're not going to be around anymore.
Yes.
And because everything comes and goes. And I think some businesses, I mean, look at some huge businesses. I mean, where are they now? You know, never had someone in there to look at the future and say, how are we going to sustain, you know, our growth, whatever, in the future? It's sure. It's really unappreciated resilience. I don't think it's given the time that it should be. But
Yeah. And I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The Black Swan, but Nassim Taleb, who's
Taleb, that's right.
He goes, you know, goes beyond resilience into this concept of anti-fragility, which is something that, you know, when there's volatility, it's something that gets better, which is, we're not even thinking about that. But resilience is, you know, is incredibly, personal resilience is incredibly important. But
I think it comes down to ownership as well. You know, if you own your mistakes and you say to people, these are my errors. You know, I think a lot of people don't own mistakes anymore. They sideline them onto other people. And, you know, if only this hadn't happened, then I would have been fine. I wouldn't have lost this money if this hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. If you can embrace the ownership for your own decisions, and I write about this in the book as well. Mm-hmm. There's a great book out there by a couple of Navy SEALs called Extreme Ownership.
Yes. Yeah.
And Jocko Willink. That's a great book, really, to understand the responsibility of self. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan as well. And this would be great to chat about this some other time. I'm a great fan of sort of self-induced suffering to bring out that resilience. Mm. So whether it's, you know, training for a marathon or whether it's doing something that you don't want to do. So go and help out a homeless shelter or something, or whatever it might be. Give yourself a couple of months doing that and see what happens in the end. See what kind of person you become at the end. It's incredible. It really is incredible. So the suffering aspect is quite important to me. Ownership is another thing that I wish people would embrace more. You never get people say, oh, I made that mistake, it was mine. You always get, isn't it interesting? You always get that shifted onto someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Or something else has happened. You know, there might be an event that's happened.
Yeah, mitigating circumstances.
Yeah,
or,
sure.
Yes.
The market wasn't right. You know, I lost shares.
Yeah, well, you see that a lot in, you know, you could, you know, in certain in organizations, you could probably make a good living by deflecting ownership, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But you know, that's neither here nor there. But yeah, it's before we go, you know, you mentioned that Jocko Willink book on extreme ownership. But what are some of the other, it sounds like you read a lot. What are some of the other things that you've read, books that you've read that you'd recommend?
Okay, so I'm reading one right now on The Obstacle Is the Way
Ryan Holiday. Yeah.
That's it, Ryan Holiday. He's writing quite a few things at the moment. Yeah. I used to tap into Tim Ferriss's podcast quite a bit. Not so much anymore, but in the early days, that was some interesting stuff on there. Mm-hmm. What else am I? So there was, I think Team of Teams was a good book.
Mm-hmm.
That was by a U.S. general. I can't remember his name. No, I have to pick that one up. I'm sorry. But that was quite interesting, talking about how when teams are in silos, and you know, so we're all in silos, aren't we? All working within our departments. Well, obviously, we can get to the point where we don't necessarily embrace or listen to other people because of the fact we're in our own little team. That is Stanley McChrystal, of course, team of teams. Stanley McChrystal is about Iraq and things like that, which is quite interesting. One of the guys online I read, James Clear, writes some pretty interesting stuff. You might have stumbled across him. Geez, there's some interesting people that write some interesting things online. Who else am I reading right now? I have so many books on the go. And the thing is, a lot of my books are, when I'm at work, I live in this particular place and I have a house down south we're trying to move into. And of course, you know what happens when you read too many books? You leave them in big piles, and come, and some are on your Kindle, and you know. So those are the kind of things that I think about. In fact, what I'm thinking about doing is writing this stuff down for people that read my site, because they always ask me this stuff, and by the time they've asked me, I've kind of finished. Those kind of books, really, books that kind of explore the human spirit, really, I think are quite interesting. So that kind of stuff. As I said, anything really that talks about, you know, fragility. There's one at the moment I'm reading, I'd never be able to come up with the author's name, but that's on masculinity, and the guy's a comedian. I wish I knew what that was. I'd have to find that for you next time. That's opening yourself out. I'm sorry, I haven't got more for you.
No. That's a good start. So that's plenty. I'll put them in the show notes. Yeah, we covered an awful lot, so I want to be respectful of your time.
That's all right.
But
all right.
Before we go, for my audience members who might want to know more about you or find you, follow you, what are some of the best places to do that?
Yeah, so again, you know, I'm a serving military officer. I'm not making money out of this stuff. You realize how expensive it is to run a blog after a while, don't you? With hosting and everything.
Or a podcast,
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So my website is fastjetperformance.com. Mm-hmm. And fastjetperformance.com, I have a Twitter as well on that, but my Twitter is also TimDavies_UK. I'm not a massive fan of Twitter. Are you doing Twitter a lot?
Not a lot, but I'm on there. I need to up my game on all of these things, I think, and just choose a couple of the platforms and really get
Platforms. But exactly that. You know, Facebook's quite big for me right now. So Fast Jet Performance on Facebook. I do a lot of interaction with people on that. I've got a podcast out as well. Again, Fast Jet Performance, and I just released a post actually on my site. I think that was a couple of nights ago. So LinkedIn. I'm a big fan of LinkedIn with people. My latest post was dull day at the office, at least you're not a fighter pilot. So what that talks about was when I was over the top of Al-Mara back in southern Iraq back in 2003.
Okay.
I write long form, 2,500, 3,000 words. I think that does better. And we had a couple of guys killed on the ground, and I was over the top of them, and there was like nothing I could do about that. So I wrote that down in a big essay, and that's getting quite a bit of response now. So I'm a big fan of LinkedIn with people, and I really believe in helping out the communities that do link in. So if people want to write to me, again, tim@fastjetperformance.com. I answer everything. It takes me a while sometimes, but I answer all emails, and I'm a big fan of, you know, really helping people out. If they just want to ask me a couple of questions because they're having difficulties, you know, it's not, I'm not a guy that looks to charge people. You're the same, you know, it's just hook me an email. If I can help you out, I will, you know, it's the thing. So
yeah, that's what I, you know, I'm this is a, you know, side project for me. I've got a full-time job. I'm not, you know, I am thinking about ways to, you know, to defray the costs, honestly, but
talk to me, because I, you know, I do the same thing, Patreon, all that kind of stuff, you know. I listen to a couple of podcasts at the moment. So a couple of guys I listen to are using Patreon. They're putting donate buttons on their site. I've never done that, but you can. People don't mind doing that, you know. So
you know, I'm thinking of doing that just to offer people. I mean, it's not free. It does, but I'm, you know, this is not a business for me either. So
it takes,
you know,
money.
It is a hobby, but it can get, you know, get a little bit.
Your time adds up. You could be doing something else now. Sam Harris, I follow on a podcast as well. Quite an interesting guy.
Yeah.
Neuroscientist, I believe, and an atheist, but he talks philosophically about a lot of stuff, and he talked about how he has to, because he obviously has such bandwidth issues and everything, because he's very popular podcast. Yeah. He has to use Patreon and get people to and people don't mind doing it, because what you're putting out is quality. And when I listened to some of your podcasts you put out before, I learned so much from them, from some of the guys I was listening to. Now, I would pay for that because that's quality content. And that's what I try and deliver out to my guys as well. I'm saying and I try and get the Air Force and the Navy and the Army to do this more, to put a content out that people can listen to, because it benefits everyone. So I say to people, you know, it's hard, but if I can make a difference out there and people, you know, people will write to me and they say, you know, some of the essays I wrote really helped them get over some stuff. And that's,
sure.
that, to me,
sure.
is worth more
that's
than money.
That's worth it. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, yeah, that's great. I mean, it's, I feel a reticence of asking people for money, but I think, you know, I think that, if people, you know, just to give people an opportunity to help defray the costs, is, you know, that, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, a donate button will do it probably. Yeah, just, yeah, that, you know, that's the
yeah.
thing.
But yeah, having said that, and you know, just to be clear to my audience, that all of the episodes are free and they will always will be. But
of course, yeah, they will. Yeah, yeah, they're a good episode.
Thank you very much, Tim. This was fabulous. I really enjoyed it, right. And we ought to do this again. And you know, hopefully, we could also do a face to face as well, given that we're not that far apart.
Yeah, sure. I'll come down and see you. That's just fine. I've got some stuff to do.
If ever that happens, you know, let me know. Yeah, I, you know, I'll encourage my listeners to check you out and give you a follow. Sure. And let's stay in touch.
If I can help them out, that's a great thing. That's a great thing. All right.
Thanks so much, Tim. Really enjoyed this. This was brilliant.
No worries.
Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. Check out fastjetperformance.com. That's Tim's website. Everything is in the show notes as usual. Now, we are currently in an episode every other week mode. Once every 2 weeks, once a fortnight. So our next episode will be out in 2 weeks' time. However, we won't stay there. And I will remind you, if you're a longtime listener, that that is the minimum standard that I've set, an episode every other week. But we'll be picking up the pace after the next episode, because I have quite a few interesting episodes to get out into the world. So if you don't want to miss anything, do subscribe. allthingsrisk.co.uk or allthingsrisk.com. You'll find all the ways in which you can subscribe to the show. I am sure that there will be one that suits you. We will be back in 2 weeks. We'll speak then. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.